Hello. It is the biggest leak of military secrets ever. Al Jazeera has obtained unfettered access to almost 400,000 classified American documents. Torture, claims of murder at the checkpoints, revelations that make a mockery of the rules of combat. And for the first time, we have an official civilian death count. These are the secret Iraq files. Now, over the past 10 weeks, working with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, Al Jazeera has been reading tens of thousands of documents that we sourced through WikiLeaks. And there's a very good reason that Washington didn't want you to see them. They reveal the covering up of Iraqi state torture to truth about hundreds of civilians killed at coalition roadblocks. There are also fresh outrages involving private security contractors. And we find out what the U.S. really thinks about Iraq's prime minister. Now, we here on Al Jazeera will be revealing the truth about the war in Iraq. Now, in terms of volume, the secret material that we have obtained is more than four times larger than the WikiLeaks Afghanistan files. These cables date from January the 1st of 2004 until December the 31st of last year. There are 391,000 documents in all and 38 million words. And although each document is written in English, the files have a language all of their own. For example, we've seen more than 1,000 code words and acronyms. And if we take one of the cables in its entirety, we can show you how we translate it. Now, this one records the U.S. military finding evidence of torture at an Iraqi police station last year. At the top, we have lots of identifying information. We can see the date. We can tell what the precise area of Iraq this happened in by the GPS coordinates. And we can see that this cable is about Iraqi security forces, ISF. And finally, we're told the cable is secret. And then the summary. We can see that a unit from the 1st Cavalry Division of the U.S. Army has visited Riyadh Police Station. Here, they find not only torture victims, but torture instruments, too, being kept in the police chief's office. The Americans get medical aid for those who have been tortured and confront the police chief, who tells them he supported it as a method of conducting investigations. Now, in this next report, a so-called escalation of force event, U.S. soldiers in a convoy shoot at civilians in a vehicle. They kill the driver, a doctor taking a pregnant woman to hospital. The coalition has flagged this report as CCIR-5, meaning they know it may generate hostile publicity. An investigation is launched into the killing, although we don't know the outcome. Now, Al Jazeera is acutely aware that releasing such data might raise some concerns about security and possibly the safety of some individuals. So we have blanked out the names of people who appear in these files, victims and survivors alike. This approach has been agreed with our partners in the exercise, the New York Times, Britain's Guardian newspaper and Channel 4 TV, and Germany's Der Spiegel magazine. But just as protecting the innocent is vital, so is the public's right to know about the facts buried in these Iraq files. Now, one of the stated aims of the war in Iraq was to shut down the torture chambers of Saddam Hussein.
There will be no march for the victims of Saddam, no protests about the thousands of children that die needlessly every year under his rule, no righteous anger over the torture chambers, which, if he is left in power, are left in being.
But Tony Blair's righteous anger over torture chambers didn't mean that they stopped being there. Al Jazeera has discovered that there were more than 1,300 cases of torture and abuse of Iraqi prisoners, mostly by police and soldiers in Iraq themselves. All of them were reported, some even witnessed by coalition forces. But according to these documents, the U.S. ordered its troops not to intervene in the torture. And there are indications that that order was cleared at the highest level of the U.S. government.
It was one of the stated aims of the war to end the torture chambers. But the secret files reveal a very different story. In graphic detail, they record extensive abuse at Iraqi police stations, army bases, and prisons. On more than 1,300 occasions, U.S. troops reported the allegations to their superiors.
The detainee was blindfolded, beaten about the feet and legs with a blunt object, punched in the face and head. Electricity was used on his feet and genitals, and he was sodomized with a water bottle.
The alleged torturers claimed the victim had fallen off his motorbike, but the Americans record that this was
not consistent with the man's injuries.
There are many such reports. This one says that
the detainee was jabbed with a screwdriver, struck with cables in the arms, back, and legs, electrocuted, and sodomized with a hose.
Sometimes the report is stark.
Iraqi police beat detainee to death.
Day after day, U.S. troops report torture allegations and torture scenes, some of which appear to have been posted on the internet. But instead of their superiors trying to stop the torture, something very different happened. Just 2 months after the U.S.'s own torture scandal of Abu Ghraib, we've discovered in the secret files a military order. It's called Frago 242.
Frago 242, provided the initial report confirms the U.S. forces were not involved in the detainee abuse. No further investigation will be conducted unless directed by higher headquarters.
Fragmentary Order, or Frago 242, apparently ruled out any U.S. intervention in Iraqi-on-Iraqi torture. A second order, Frago 039, issued in April 2005, did require U.S. personnel to report Iraqi-on-Iraqi abuse to their superiors, but again, to take no further action unless ordered.
Frago 039 now requires reports of Iraqi-on-Iraqi abuse be reported through operational channels.
The Frago orders appear to originate from an initial order signed by the commander of coalition ground forces in Iraq in 2004, General Ricardo Sanchez. Some of the reports do appear to have been investigated, yet according to Amnesty International, no Iraqi personnel have ever received a custodial sentence for torture.
I think that's quite wrong. If that is the order, then quite clearly, you know, the US, as other governments, have a responsibility to act against torture. And if information about torture, including not by their own forces, comes to their attention, then they need to do something about it.
There is evidence that Frago 242 and Frago 039 were also known about at the highest levels of US government. The most senior man in the US military was convinced his troops should be stopping torture in 2005. Then US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld had different ideas.
It is absolutely the responsibility of every U.S. service member, if they see inhumane treatment being conducted, to intervene to stop it.
And I don't think you mean they have an obligation to physically stop it. It's to report it.
Rumsfeld's correction is telling.
If they are physically present when inhumane treatment is taking place, or they have an obligation to try to stop it.
U.S. troops have been informing their superiors of torture carried out by the Iraqi police and army for years, yet were apparently ordered only to report it, not to stop it. Some senior Iraqi police officers did try to act against the torture, but were warned off, making the U.S. position even more worrying.
There was another abuse which I supervised the investigation of. The rape of one of the detainees. He was 15 years old, and he was raped by a major. Someone came to my house and threatened me. Either you abandon this case, or anything could happen to you.
The U.S. did claim to investigate torture at Iraq's prisons. Reports show U.S. troops inspected Iraqi detention facilities on seven occasions between late November 2005 and March 2006, and found nothing, as the coalition spokesman told reporters in Baghdad.
The facilities were, by our standards, overcrowded, but the people being held at those facilities were being properly taken care of. They were being fed, they had water, they were taken care of. So no abuse, no evidence of torture in those facilities.
But what reporters weren't told is that during the exact period when the U.S. says it was finding no torture, its own troops were finding something very different. U.S. soldiers reported to their superiors 41 separate incidents of alleged abuse by Iraqi police or soldiers in the same period. They include multiple claims of detainees being beaten, including with chains, and a detainee who says that he was electrocuted. Even though the secret files may not relate to the specific sites of inspections, they are direct proof that the coalition knew that torture was still happening and that the US had chosen to turn its back.
So, what does the Pentagon have to say about the facts uncovered in these secret files? Our correspondent Tom Ackerman has been finding out.
The Pentagon had long anticipated the disclosures of the 400,000 items that WikiLeaks released on Friday. By anticipating, we mean that they had set up an information review task force, basically to provide early warning or subsequent warning to any personnel who might have been mentioned by name in the documents to warn them of possible exposure. But for more on the actual details of some of the documents, with me is Jeff Morrell, the Pentagon spokesman. Jeff, let me ask you, first of all, the allegation that the United States forces at the ground level merely reported the abuses and torture on the part of Iraqi army and police, but did not go further. Why wasn't there a more aggressive intervention?
Well, Tom, let me start by just saying up front, I'm not going to get into the specifics of elite classified documents. That just compounds the problem here. But what I would tell you, though, is that it has always been our policy, when our forces are to come upon any evidence, any signs of torture or abuse, to report that up their chain of command. And at the appropriate level, that information is then passed on to the Iraqi security forces for them to investigate and hopefully take disciplinary action and then, frankly, change the behavior of their forces that are engaged in that type of behavior. With regards to us intervening, I clearly have seen examples in the press accounts of this document release that indicate there were many instances where our forces did intervene when we came upon instances of abuse. But our fundamental posture was that, and in most of the cases I understand here, we mostly were coming across situations where we found evidence of abuse after the fact, but we're not actually seeing it take place ourselves. In those cases, our responsibility was to report it up to the chain of command and then notify the appropriate Iraqis.
What about the striking number of incidents of checkpoint shootings of innocent civilians? General McChrystal himself has publicly talked about that in the case of Afghanistan. So was there any kind of remedial action taken to minimize those?
That is one of the most difficult and dangerous jobs that our forces face in the field, whether it be in Afghanistan or in Iraq. Remember, we're dealing with an enemy that hides among the people, that disguises him or herself as a civilian, that uses taxi cabs and ambulances even loaded with explosives to execute attacks on us and others. So checkpoints were always extraordinarily dangerous. This is a fine line. There often were split-second decisions. We didn't always make them as well as we could have in retrospect. And there were actions that were taken over the course of this conflict to make sure we were better, more discerning, more discriminate at these checkpoints. And I think you'll see that we clearly improved in that respect over the years. We have never been infallible in that regard, and we regret that. But we have certainly done everything in our power to minimize, if not avoid, civilian casualties altogether. It goes counter to the whole premise of our counterinsurgency campaign. We're trying to win the trust and confidence of the people. You don't do that by killing civilians.
Let me go back to the instances of abuse by Iraqi forces. Was there a systematic follow-up? And in fact, right now, the U.S. forces are continuing to train the Army and police. Is there any ongoing oversight over that kind of abuse?
Well, listen, it is our contention that the Iraqi security forces of today are clearly not the same Iraqi security forces of 2004, which these documents date back to. They have shown dramatic improvement over the course of the last 6 or 7 years. Are they perfect? No. Frankly, nor are our forces. We have to constantly be on guard and vigilant, and constantly be training our forces and their forces about the proper behavior and the proper response in each and every situation we are likely to come across. But I think overall we've seen a dramatic improvement in the Iraqi security forces.
And let me just ask you about the overall number of civilian casualties. The numbers that seem to be indicated by these documents is that they were far greater than what the American command had acknowledged at the time, or has acknowledged at the time, and that, in fact, at some points, there was a denial that there were, in fact, any kind of tally being taken by the Pentagon.
We have always kept records of those casualties, those civilians who have been killed, others who have been killed that we have come across, we have witnessed, we have been engaged in. We have been very forthcoming about those numbers over the years. There are detailed reports which are presented to Congress. These are public documents.
Excuse me, the numbers were actually disclosed?
The numbers were disclosed. But the difference, Tom, is this. We have never professed to have some sort of total count of casualties that took place since 2003 in Iraq. And I don't believe that anybody could give you such a count. The only thing we could reliably present were those casualties that we witnessed, that we happened upon, that we were involved in. We gave that information to the United States Congress. Those are public documents. You can
Would you find that those are accurate, given the documents that we've seen now?
They're accurate to the best of our ability about what we witnessed. But we were not everywhere at once. We were not where all the killings were taking place in Iraq. Remember, this country was in the midst of a near civil war for years, where you had Shia and Sunni killing each other at alarming rates. Much of that was taking place out of our reach, out of our sight. So we have no idea of the total scope of casualties in Iraq. What we have done over the years is provide those which we witnessed, which we were a part of, which we came upon. And so this notion that somehow we have been trying to hide the toll of this conflict is nonsense. We have never tried to do such a thing. We've been very transparent in that regard, but we've never at the same time even ever professed to have a total count of the toll caused by this conflict.
All right, Jeff Morrell, thank you very much for speaking with us. Obviously, there's a rebuttal by many of the people who are still looking through the actual details of these 400,000 files about many of the contentions that the Pentagon had issued prior to their release and subsequent to their release. And we will be hearing a lot more about that probably in the days to come. Also, projection by Julian Assange, the head of the founder of WikiLeaks, that in fact some wrongful death lawsuits may follow as a result of these disclosures. That's also something that the Pentagon will have to contend with. Reporting from the Pentagon, I'm Tom Ackerman. Back to you in the studio.
All right. Well, joining me now from London is Jonathan Goldberg, a human rights barrister. Thank you for being with us. We've had Mark Kimmett from the State Department saying that the torture allegations don't apply to the U.S. because they were there invited by the Iraqi government and so had no role in anything that might have happened. And then we've had the State Department there, the Pentagon rather, spokesman there, Jeff Morrell, suggesting there that the U.S. didn't really have anything to do there. They reported what they saw after the event or what they had come across after the event, and they could do no more. From your perspective, what does international law tell us about the U.S.'s responsibility in the situation that they were in?
Well, this is all very deeply regrettable, but I have no doubt that the international conventions which the United States has signed against torture, and there are several of them, undoubtedly demand, they don't just allow states who have signed to prosecute torturers, but they positively demand that those states should take action against torturers. So it's not good enough, I'm afraid, in international law that a soldier stands by and watches it and then reports higher up to United States superior authority and that nothing is done. That undoubtedly, in my view, is a breach of the international treaties which the United States undoubtedly has signed. It's just like piracy, for example. There's a positive obligation in international law for states to stamp it out.
You're referring there specifically to the situations in which U.S. soldiers either were aware of or even observed cases of torture taking place. What about the circumstance where the U.S., only very recently when they pulled out of Iraq or began the pullout of Iraq, handed over prisoners from their custody to Iraq custody? Now, if the U.S. was aware that this torture was taking place, is that very act of handing over prisoners itself a violation of international law?
Well, I think the answer is it is, because since the United States has signed treaties that impose a positive obligation, I repeat, on the states signing to stamp out these practices, not just to stand by or turn the other way or turn your back, but a positive obligation to stamp them out, then to hand over men when they have good reason to believe those men will be tortured or indeed killed is, I'm afraid, undoubtedly a breach of the same obligations.
All right.
It has a certain parallel, doesn't it, with what went on after the Second World War, when even a man as great as Churchill allowed Cossacks to be handed back to Stalin, knowing full well that they would be executed.
And Churchill's treatment, if you like, of that, or the backlash against Churchill didn't exist. And in this case, are we not looking at a similar circumstance? It's all very well and good to talk about theoretical laws, but who is there to hold the U.S. accountable, and are we likely to see any action?
Well, there's a saying, isn't there, that in war all laws are silent, and that's what we're watching. In war all laws are silent, and that's what we're watching at the moment.
Thanks very much indeed for being with us, Jonathan Goldberg. Now, war in general is full of unpleasant euphemisms, such as collateral damage or friendly fire. And now we can add a new one, escalation of force. Supposedly, this is a safety procedure, but it's resulted in the wrongful killing of hundreds of innocent civilians. We can reveal that almost 700 civilians have been shot dead by coalition convoys and at checkpoints when this escalation of force protocol went wrong.
Camille and Hussein Hassan were driving home quickly in Tal Afar. Curfew was approaching and they were keen to get home. As they approached a checkpoint, a photographer filmed events. U.S. soldiers suspecting the approaching car opened fire, as the Secret Files report.
A shot was fired at the front tire, but the vehicle did not stop. The patrol engaged the vehicle, killing two civilians. There were six children in the back seat. All were unharmed.
Both parents were killed, their orphaned children were covered in their blood. This shocking fatal incident turns out to be one of hundreds of so-called escalation of force deaths described in detail in the Secret Files. Perceiving themselves to be at constant risk from suicide bombers, U.S. soldiers manning checkpoints and driving convoys were often edgy. Any civilian in their eyes might pose a risk. If soldiers sensed a threat, they could engage in what we now know as an escalation of force. Hand signals, flashing lights, and warning shots were all supposed to be used. Most escalations ended harmlessly. The files record almost 14,000 incidents across Iraq, but in some cases, people died. The American reports claim their procedures were carried out every time. Videos posted on the internet by soldiers suggest a far more cavalier and reckless approach to Iraqi lives by some. The United States has always claimed it has not kept full records of escalation of force deaths. The files prove otherwise. Al Jazeera has discovered that 681 civilians have been killed at coalition checkpoints and by passing convoys. 120 so-called insurgents also died. Just 13 coalition deaths are recorded. There are accounts of the deaths of drivers, passengers, pedestrians, and cyclists via checkpoints and convoys.
Sentry opened fire and shot cyclist in the stomach.
Bullet ricochets and hits one local national, 9-year-old girl.
The man was said to have been mentally handicapped.
We've also found reports of pedestrians killed not for carrying explosives, but for a suspicious pack of grain, a case of books, cigarettes, or an empty plastic bag. Escalation of forced deaths grew rapidly in Iraq. In 2004, there were 22 civilians killed. The next year, that rose to 278 civilians killed. The map shows how incidents track the lines of Iraq's roads. But if we look only at fatal escalations, it tells a very different story. Deaths occur almost exclusively in the Sunni areas of central Iraq.
From 2004 onwards, they started shooting with weapons, warning shots up to the sky. But after that, they started shooting civilians.
Colonel Al-Shaikhli described to Al Jazeera an incident in one of his police districts.
There was a family driving in a car, and the American convoy wanted to overtake them. So the civilian driver became confused. He was an older man, and he didn't know whether to move left or right. And so the car was shot at and burned to the ground with the family inside.
In 2006, the U.S. military began to change its rules on escalations of force, worried about the impact of so many civilian deaths. Death rates did drop, but many more were still to die. Confusion or a simple mistake could have deadly consequences. 75-year-old Kakarish Ali Khalid died at a U.S. roadblock in Kirkuk in January 2007. His nephew, Karzan Shirabiani, is a London-based filmmaker. Trying to find out why the Americans killed his uncle, he went to Kirkuk in search of answers. The Americans refused to speak to him about what happened.
I was lucky enough to have witnesses. He was shot dead by Americans at a checkpoint.
Kakarish is one of the 681 civilians whose killing is detailed in the secret files.
The gunner waved his hands, yelled, and showed his weapon with intent to use it. When the vehicle was 75 meters from location, the gunner fired a second burst of 9 rounds. Local national exited the car and walked approximately 10 meters and laid on the ground.
Al Jazeera showed Karzan the coalition report the first time he was able to see the American version of events. It contradicts what witnesses told him about his uncle's death.
I just don't need to carry on reading this because this is completely in contrast to the eyewitness. For what they have seen here, it says they have shot 5 shots and the cars carried on moving into their direction, but that is not what the eyewitnesses told me, that the minute they shot the first shot, my uncle stopped and turned the car around and they carried on shooting. He was shot probably with a stray of bullets. I counted myself about 86.
For Karzan, the document drives the point that those responsible for escalation of forced deaths must be brought to justice.
If they are not responsible now for these killings, tomorrow they will do it again and again and again.
Hundreds of families across Iraq should now be able to learn about the days on which their loved ones were gunned down in escalations of force.
Now, after the break, we'll go to get an Iraqi political reaction. First, though, time for a short break. Stay with us. Hello again, if you've just joined us. This is an Al Jazeera News special on the secret Iraq war files. Over the past 10 weeks, working with the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London, we've been reading tens of thousands of documents that we got through WikiLeaks. and find that they reveal the cover-up of Iraqi state torture. The founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, she joins me now from London. Julian, thanks for being with us. The picture that has been painted, I mean, you've seen now how the various media have portrayed it and interpreted the documents that you have leaked. What's your analysis of how it's been presented? Does it actually give an accurate, a fair, even a particularly insightful vision of what's been going on in Iraq?
Yes, it does. We see, for example, 15,000 civilian casualties in this material that were not previously reported in international media, in Iraqi media, or in publicly released government
documents. Let me stop you there for just a second, if I could. Because that's a good case in point. Now, you put the number 15,000 forward, and a lot of the media have focused on 15,000, as has Iraq body count. But what's also become reasonably apparent through these documents is that even that number is probably not particularly accurate. So should we say it's 15,000 more, or should we actually be looking at these numbers in a slightly more abstract way?
Well, it is certainly more than 15,000, but what we can see from this material is 15,000 additional. There are 109,000 self-reported casualties detailed in these documents. 66,000 of those self-reported are civilian casualties, covering the 6 years that this material consumes. It is probably only 50% of the military action or interaction in Iraq. It doesn't cover anything, everything. It doesn't cover the CIA's activities. It doesn't cover most of the new Iraqi army or police forces' activities. It doesn't cover the British government, except when the US Army intersects with it. But it is, without doubt, the most significant description of what has happened in the Iraq war, or in fact any war.
All right. The Pentagon has released its statement, and in some ways they've been very quiet on this. They've merely rehashed pretty much what they said after the Afghanistan leak, which is that you're damaging their ability to function and to operate effectively and putting lives in danger. Do you think that they've backed up that accusation with any real fact?
No, they haven't, in any means whatsoever. And in fact, in relation to the Afghan release just last week, NATO said in Kabul to CNN that they hadn't been able to find a single person in Afghanistan that needed to be protected or moved. And the Pentagon said it's not aware of anyone who had been harmed by the release of our Afghan material. So tremendous overplay by the Pentagon. But for 50 years, that institution, when receiving criticism, has come out, as it did in the famous 1970s Pentagon Papers case, and said, well, it's going to harm the troops. That, as far as I'm aware, has in fact never happened with media leaks, and I do not expect it to happen in this case. So this material is of no okay. tactical consequence, but it is certainly important to the people of Iraq, and important to understand how militaries behave and to hold them to account.
Nonetheless, the U.S. Government, the U.S. military, are determined, apparently, to try and put an end to your organization and to what you do. You mentioned the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, who was responsible for those, Craig Murray, the British ambassador who blew the whistle on events while he was ambassador as well, were at your press conference today. Which do you think is the dominant force right now? The whistleblowers beginning to gather some momentum, or the governments acting to clamp down on people who would reveal secrets?
Well, elements within the United States government can ask for that if they like, but they will receive considerable resistance from this organization and the world press. You know, the Pentagon has stepped too far in threatening the world press with effectively espionage charges if it reports on our material. People are simply not going to tolerate that. And if the Pentagon continues on down that path, rather than opening up and owning up to these very serious atrocities and war crimes that have been revealed, it will simply lose credibility. And as a result, the United States will also lose credibility. Fortunately, the Pentagon has some good people in it. It's not uniformly evil. There are good voices, and presumably it is some of those voices that have given us this material in order for that institution to be reformed.
We've just had the Prime Minister of Iraq, Mr. al-Maliki, giving a press conference in which he accuses you of trying to sabotage his re-election. What's your response?
Well, not at all. In fact, we are trying to give the people of Iraq their real history and the history of how their families have died and how their country has suffered. And that is a real history that the people of Iraq can use in order to determine who it is that they want to support to have govern their country.
Well, Iraq's interior minister has given his reaction to these revelations. Here's what he had to say.
Any violations of human rights in any way and by anyone are condemned by our law and by the nature of the new Iraq. The Ministry of Interior keeps a close eye on all reports of human rights violations, and there are committees who continue to investigate such reports. These committees are monitored by a specific body. No one person is above the law. No matter how long it takes to investigate some of these claims, at the end there are courts and there are legal actions that will be implemented, punishing anyone who commits such crimes against any Iraqi.
Well, Saleh Mohammed al-Mutlaq is an Iraqi politician, the head of the Iraqi Front for National Dialogue, which is the largest Sunni party in Iraq's parliament, and he joins me now. Thank you for being with us. The Interior Minister is suggesting there, not explicitly stating that they're going to try and persecute some of these cases of torture, but suggesting that Iraqi law will handle this. Do you have faith that anything will come from this leak?
No, actually, since the existing system, the existing government is in place, I would not expect that people will get the right. There will be real courts. We know very well how the judges are working now. They are under pressure from the government. So the law is not independent. Everything in the law aspect is being politicized. So I would not expect from the existing government to do anything.
Do you think anything will change as a consequence of this leak?
Well, nothing will change until the government will be changed. And when it will be changed, then we will find out that the number of the crimes that has been reported in this report will be multiplied by a high factor. At that time, the Iraqis will have their all right. They will be free to say what had been done to them. Now, the reports is only coming from outside. The Iraqis are not being able to tell the world what happened in this country. But when the Iraqis are free to say that, then the world will discuss.
Well, let me stop you there.
Why
are Iraqis not free to say what's happening in their country?
Because if they say anything, they will be taken to jail. I have seen many people who were released from jail and freed because they had done nothing, but they were tortured in a very inhuman way. And then when I asked them, why don't you tell the media? Why don't you tell the others? They said, they told us, if you tell anything, then we will get you back. So everybody now is silent. They are waiting the time when then they will give their cases to the court, but at the right time.
But look,
and then they will say what had been done to them at the right time.
You keep talking about changing the government, but what kind of government do you want to see? We've had an election already. There is a large representation of Sunni contingent in that government. There are a number of people who can make a difference there. What exactly is it that can change that will satisfy you?
We need a government that can do the change in this country. And the election was done. Al-Iraqi got the highest number of votes and of seats. And legally, constitutionally, it should make up the government. But Iran stood up and it made obstacles against Al-Iraqi to make the government. And unfortunately, al-Maliki government was being supported by the United States since a long time. Until now, maybe after what had been shown in this report, then the United States can never support al-Maliki government. Can never support al-Maliki to be back in power again. Al-Maliki was to stay in power to cover up these crimes. And the crimes will not be discovered, unless this government is being removed and a fair government, a non-sectarian government will come to Iraq to show the people how life can be changed in democracy. Now, there is no real democracy in Iraq since Iran is interfering in this country to that extent, and since the world is being silenced against what's being done in this country.
Now, let's bring you some details on what we've found about private security companies that have been operating in Iraq. These are guns for hire who are actually protected by the coalition, even if they killed civilians. Blackwater is now known as Z. It held the most lucrative contract of all, protecting U.S. diplomats from possible attack. Now, the secret coalition files reveal that there were at least 14 other cases of Blackwater employees opening fire on civilians. That's 10 more deaths to add to the well-publicized events at Nisour Square. But no one from Blackwater has ever been charged.
In 2007, a Blackwater convoy opened fire on civilians in Nisour Square, central Baghdad. It was indiscriminate, killing 17 and wounding 18 others. The secret files record a US patrol stumbling upon the carnage.
The lead local national vehicle, containing one male, one female, and one infant, erupted into flames after the engagement.
On that day, as on many others, Blackwater was escorting US diplomats, a service for which it received over $465 million. Yet the Iraqi government had no control over Blackwater.
I can tell you we hated them. We hated them because they were, again, a law unto themselves. One of their primary functions was to protect U.S. officials. And this is the way they're trained. They're trained to protect at all costs. And in the process, think of the other people around them as either targets or as threats. And they respond in ways that would not be acceptable for their equivalent in, say, Western societies.
Now, analysis of the secret U.S. files has found 14 further cases where Blackwater opened fire on civilians, wounding 7 and killing 10. In 1 in 3 of those Blackwater killings detailed in the secret files, the company was escorting U.S. diplomats. The first death we've identified was May the 14th, 2005, witnessed by a U.S. patrol who were themselves almost hit.
They observed a Blackwater private security detail shoot up a civilian vehicle.
The father of a family was killed, the mother and daughter wounded. The Blackwater truck did not stop. In May 2006, Blackwater opened fire on an ambulance.
The Americans were passing. There was a bomb, and then they shot him.
Ambulance driver was killed by uncontrolled small arms firing by the coalition forces' civilian convoy.
Despite Jassim Abdel Sahan's death, Blackwater refused to confirm or deny its involvement. Blackwater escorted hundreds of convoys over the years, a target. But the secret files paint a picture, not of Blackwater acting in self-defense, but of its employees out of control. In February 2005, the files reveal that 4 civilians were wounded after an unknown private security detail, or PSD, opened fire. On that same day in Baghdad, a Blackwater convoy escorting diplomats opened fire at 3 cars, killing at least 1 person. The State Department's Diplomatic Security Service investigated that incident. These are its findings.
Agents concluded that several of the private security detail individuals involved in the shooting provided false statements to the investigators, as well as failed to justify their actions.
Yet, the US government refused to punish Blackwater.
Disciplinary actions would be deemed as a lowering the morale of the entire PSD entity.
In 2007, the Iraqi government demanded Blackwater leave, but the company simply ignored them. The next year, the US State Department actually renewed Blackwater's Iraq contract. No Blackwater employee has ever been punished for killing an Iraqi civilian.
Well, Jeremy Scahill is the author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. And he joins me now. Jeremy, thank you for being with us. Has anything that was revealed in these documents surprised you?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm speaking to you from Kabul, Afghanistan, where Blackwater still guards the U.S. ambassador here, Carl Eikenberry. They still train Afghan national police forces. They still engage in counter-narcotics operations. And if anything, what Al Jazeera has revealed through these WikiLeaks documents should really serve as another piece of evidence that it's time for the Obama administration to fire Blackwater once and for all. No, I wasn't surprised by what I read in the WikiLeaks documents, but what the headline I think really is here about Blackwater is that the U.S. State Department was aware that Blackwater was killing civilians. In fact, they were killing civilians while protecting U.S. diplomats, and they have effectively covered up Blackwater's crimes because they said it would hurt morale of the Blackwater forces. Where's the questioning of what it was doing to the Iraqi people that were on the other side of Blackwater's guns, and also to the stated mission of the United States of winning hearts and minds? No, this isn't surprising, but it should serve as more evidence that it's really time for the Obama administration to fire these mercenaries.
Just to go back to your original point, what is the status of Blackwater going forward? Because Hamid Karzai says he's banned all mercenary forces, all private security groups from being in Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, you know, Hamid Karzai is under the false impression that he's actually in charge of whether Blackwater stays or goes in Afghanistan. Look at what happened when Nouri al-Maliki tried to expel Blackwater. It took 3 years before Blackwater was actually expelled from that country. In fact, I spoke recently to an Afghan government official who conceded to me that the Karzai government is making a deal with the United States to allow Blackwater to continue operating in Afghanistan as long as they're classified as the diplomatic security for Ambassador Carl Eichmann. That gives you a real sense of who's calling the shots here in Afghanistan, and I'll tell you what, it's not Hamid Karzai.
So the revelations from Nisour Square didn't yield hardly anything in terms of reaction to Blackwater, in terms of persecutions of those responsible. Do you expect it to be the same with these leaks, or do you think that maybe Blackwater, or Z as they are now known, has been exposed to the point where something must be done?
No, I think one of the sad realities of the U.S. government right now is that even under the administration of Barack Obama, where he campaigned on a pledge to bring the change that people in America and the world needed, the fact that he can't discontinue Blackwater's use, the fact that they can't effectively prosecute what are very clear war crimes, is a sad commentary on how little things have actually changed when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. The U.S. still relies on mercenaries in Iraq, Afghanistan, and unfortunately, it's a phenomenon that's spreading around the world.
Well, you're talking about power and ability to prosecute. Just trace for us, if you would, who is in Blackwater that has so much power, and through what connections are they able to exercise this kind of power?
Right. Well, look, Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, has been a CIA asset since at least 2002, when Blackwater forces first came into Afghanistan. He's been involved with lethal operations on behalf of the United States government. He knows where the bodies are buried. And in fact, he's engaged in what's called gray mail, where he's essentially made a threat to the U.S. government that if you try to prosecute me and shut down my operations, I'm going to reveal all the dirty secrets that I know.
Do you have evidence?
And I'll guarantee you this. Yes, I certainly do. And I'll, in fact, Blackwater participated in what are called F-cubed operations, find, fix, and finish operations, including in U.S. allies such as Germany. These guys know where a lot of the bodies are buried, and there are many within the U.S. government that I think don't want the true story of Blackwater to come to light. WikiLeaks documents that were released on Blackwater are merely the tip of the iceberg. Let's start digging into what they were doing outside of stated battlefields, and you're going to find a very grim tale.
One of the things that's occurred to me with these documents, albeit it's a very sketchy picture, but there seems to be a much more casual approach towards death and killing and operating amongst these private security groups. Would you say that's true? And would you say that this is particularly true for Blackwater, or do they all operate this way?
Well, I think Blackwater is a particularly rotten apple in a batch of bad apples. And I'll say this. Blackwater and other private security companies, their primary job is to keep alive the most important people in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. And those people aren't the citizens of Afghanistan and Iraq. Their job is not winning hearts and minds. If they need to shoot at a vehicle that comes too close to the American ambassador or another senior official, they will not hesitate for one moment to shoot. Blackwater's policy has been shoot first and then don't ask any questions later.
Now, everything that you've been hearing has been collated from the documents that we've had that has managed to allow us to paint this unique big picture view of the Iraq war. And our analysis, let me just sum it up for you again, shows that despite the repeated public denials, the U.S. has also been keeping records on the deaths and injuries in Iraq. This is what they show. 285,000 recorded casualties, including at least 109,000 deaths. Now, of those who were killed, 66,000, nearly two-thirds of the total, were civilians. Now, up until now, the most widely acknowledged count of civilian deaths has been kept by an organization called the Iraq Body Count. And their estimate has put the number of civilian deaths in Iraq at 107,000 since the invasion. But now, IBC says, it'll be raising its estimate by 15,000 to more than 122,000 civilian deaths.
We've discovered that there are likely to be an additional 15,000 Iraqi civilian and local police deaths that have not been reported in any other source so far. In addition, there are deaths that are categorized here as enemy, which we and others would have categorized as civilian. And we think that there's likely to be about another 3,500 such deaths that will emerge from these logs once they're fully analyzed.
Joining me now live from Amman is Adnan Hayajna, professor of political science at the Hashemite University of Jordan. Thank you for being with us. Give us your impression from Jordan of what these WikiLeaks documents have revealed. Do they tell you anything that you didn't already know about life in Iraq?
I think we knew about the torture that's going on in Iraq, and we knew about the misbehavior of the United States and the Iraqi government, and we knew so many random events that's really happened and still goes on in Iraq. But I think what we saw from the early analysis of this WikiLeaks, I think listening to Al Jazeera International, we saw that there's an evidence for that support most of the people and most of the thinking of what really happens in Iraq. It is an evidence on the hands of the people, of the Arab people, I think the American people, that the U.S. government was involved in such activities of torture that, and also breaches something different. It breaches the democracy and the human rights and all of these noble things. But the reality, there was a torture and killing, and this is all against the American values. And I'm not really surprised, because this is also correlated with what's really happening to Arabs, not only in Iraq, Arabs in Gaza, Arabs in Lebanon, Arabs and Muslims all around the world. It seems to me that Arabs and Muslims, their life is worthless, and nobody's thinking about them. The American government and the Pentagon is talking about security and the lives of the people, and nobody even have thought about these 66,000 civilians that were killed. Nobody has talked about them. Now I really understand why Iraqis are leaving Iraq and why they are fleeing, and nobody's listening to the plea of the government. Iraq is secure.
Seems to be a consensus among lawyers. The UN has already said, the UN rapporteur on torture has said, and international lawyers have said that there are war crimes being committed and that the US has some answers to give. However, not many people seem to think that the U.S. is prepared to give those answers. Do you agree? And how do you think the Arab nations are going to respond to this state of affairs?
Well, let me, Jeff, answer the first part of your question. The first part is the Americans will not respond. The Americans have won this war without any legal coverage, without international law, without any consensus from the United Nations and other international powers. So I think they will find excuses just to go away from this question. And I don't think, who's going to question the United States? And who is going to ask the United States to respond to this? I'm not sure if the Arabs can do that, or the United Nations could do that, or I think these people, I think they're, or the, not these people, I think this government is over the international law. What is the public reaction? Your second part of the question? I think the reaction will be, I think, outrageous. I would say, well, we have took so many earthquakes here in the region, but I think this is, will give answers to many of the people here in the region and to the American people, and they will give them an answer why, when the Americans ask the question why they hate us,
okay,
and this is maybe an answer for them.
If the Arab nations are going to be angry, if the Arab people are going to be angry, should they really be blaming the United States? I mean, how much responsibility do the Arab governments hold for not taking a stronger line on this and for being in cahoots in some cases with U.S. policy?
Well, I think the Arabs, the Arab states are divided into two camps, one with the Americans, one against them. And it seems to me that the Americans implicitly supporting the Iranian forces and the opposite forces of this pro-American states. And most of the states in the Arab world are not democratic, so they will not even allow anybody to question the credibility of these leaks.
And we've come to the end of this particular look at the secret Iraq files, the 391,000 classified documents, 38 million words. It's been the biggest leak of military secrets in history. And just a quick recap of some of the things we've learned. In 6 years of war, the U.S. has been keeping a death toll despite repeated denials. 109,000 Iraqis have been killed. 66,000 of them were civilians, although that figure is probably much higher.